Well, I'm very excited today to be with you, and I got up early this morning, about 5 a.m., to come visit with a very special man and have the privilege of sharing his presence with you as well. I got to drive over the mountains here in Nevada and made it here to the south shore of Lake Tahoe, and the person I'm with is a gentleman who for almost 2 decades now has been a light for millions of people, a person who's really touched people and gotten them to remember who they really are and what's most important in life. And the man I'm speaking of is Dr. Leo Biscaglia. I am incredibly privileged to be with you, Leo. I'm really excited about being on the chance to chat with you today.
Well, I'm very excited too, Tony. We've been anticipating this for weeks now. It's like we brought the snow for you, and you're Santa Claus.
Well, I appreciate that. Meeting you for the first time, having read your books and heard so many wonderful and incredible things about you, all I can say is to the people that have a relationship with me, they're all understated, not overstated, about what an incredibly loving presence and man you are. And just in the few minutes we've visited, I've really been touched by you, and I'm sure our listeners will be as you've continued to for so long. You started out, I know years and years ago, but I think maybe the first major national exposure was when your first book came out, Love, back in 1972, and you've done now almost a dozen books and about the same number of PBS specials. I know at USC, people said that, I often heard it quoted, that you were a person that brought honor to the profession of teaching. And I think that's true from what I've seen and what I've heard. I'd be curious to start out by just having people get an idea of what's brought you to this place in your life where you're so in touch with what's most important, with love and with people and with relationship. What's the genesis of that focus and that feeling?
You know, Tony, I don't think I could come into focus with that. I think it's been always my eagerness to live life fully and to recognize that around every corner there was excitement and wonder and mystery and an insatiable desire to understand all of those things and to experience them, you know. My father used to say all the time, he was a very wise Italian immigrant, had a fifth grade education, which shows you that wisdom has nothing to do with the years of education one has. But anyway, he used to say that the worst sin in the world was going to bed at night as stupid as you had awakened in the morning. And that's been kind of a way of life for me. Even as a child, I recognized the wisdom of that. So I guess I spent my life in discovery. I wanted to know everything. I wanted to experience everything. I wanted to know everyone. And I was never satisfied with just being placated by knowing the person next door or reading one book. I wanted to read hundreds of books. In fact, one of the early experiences of my life was that I went into our public library and I decided on the spot I was going to read every book in that library. So without saying anything to anyone, I got my little library card and I checked out 6 books, which you were limited to, and then I'd go home and read and plow through those 6 books. And finally, my child's librarian in there recognized what I was doing. And so she took me aside, and I'll never forget this, and then there's a wonderful story that follows it, but she took me onto the garden behind Malabar Street Branch Library, and she told me about good taste. And she said, you know, just because a book is in the library doesn't mean it's worth reading. She said there are some great books there, and there are some awful books. And if you start with A and read through to Z, you're going to spend all of your life in A and B, because I keep putting new books under A and B. Wow. So let me show you some of the great books. And she gave me 6 books that I went home and was just enchanted over.
What were they?
My goodness. I remember, well, some of them were the usual stuff, like, you know, Robert Louis Stevenson, right, and the Pathfinder, and The Last of the Mohicans, and Melville, you know, and all those wonderful things, which I realized were just stupendous. But she sort of changed my life, and she was also the one responsible for giving me my first book, because she realized that, to me, there was such a reverence for wanting to know and to experience. And just recently, USC had an evening honoring me for my achievements in the last 20 or so years as a professor there. And they invited all kinds of wonderful people. And interestingly enough, they invited my librarian.
Oh, wow.
And,
she
is
great.
Now in her 80s.
Oh, my gosh.
She is as young and youthful and beautiful as she always was.
Oh, that is fantastic.
And talk about breaking my heart when I saw her and all these memories catapulted flood, yeah. around me, you know, that were so wonderful. But, you know, to say that I have had a goal, a specific goal, would be inaccurate. But to say that I embrace, I open my arms to everything, yes. to all experiences, to all people. And to do that, you must be very vulnerable. And some people see this as foolishness. I see it as the most essential trait for changing and for growing and for becoming.
What's given you the courage to be vulnerable?
Maybe a lot of scars. You know, I
from
always
from not being vulnerable.
I always say from being vulnerable. I always say that every lover worth the name is covered with stars. Isn't that marvelous?
I was going to say a great Freudian slip.
That is
my lover.
Beautiful.
That's your
yes.
real belief. There's your unconscious
every
belief.
Every lover is covered with stars. Oh, Leo, you're
There's
so
the
poetic
truth.
Today.
There's the truth.
That's the real truth.
That's the
but,
truth.
But
but they're disguised as scars.
They take the place of. But anyway, when we try to be lovers, and we are vulnerable because a lover must be vulnerable, you're bound to encounter people that don't see what you're doing as being loving.
Right.
And so they strike out, or you're rejected.
But isn't that usually out of their own fear? What do you see the source of that?
It doesn't matter what their source is, really. They do it because that's what they believe, which is valid for them at the moment. But I must think about what I do with it then when it's done with me. So when I reach out to someone and they smack my hand, I remove it because I'm a human being and it hurts. But I say to myself, they're doing it because they need to do it. I need to do what I need to do. So when I see them again, I'm going to put my hand out again. And I find that by doing this and making myself vulnerable, after a while, they either begin to see me as very naive and therefore they don't want to hurt me.
Puppy dog.
Or very childlike.
Right.
And they say, oh, well, you know, that's just Leo. And why should we hit him when he reaches out for us? And so they're rather nice to me. And as a result, it changes their behavior.
Yes.
Too. I mean, I'm not here to tell you how to live. The only one I can tell anything about living to is myself. And I know what brings me joy, what makes me happy. And I have to be willing to accept that other people have different ideas.
So what does make you most happy?
Well, I think, first of all, people.
Yes.
I think people are the most extraordinary things. You know, I've made my life one of trying to understand behavior. And the fact that here I am, you know, in my mid-60s, and I still don't understand anything more than I did before.
And you're smart enough to know that.
I'm overwhelmed that every time I miss I meet somebody, there's something totally unique. And the minute I think that I've arrived at a universal truism, I find the exception to the rule in some human being I meet. And you know, at first that was very disconcerting and very disappointing.
Yes.
But now I find that the greatest challenge in the world, because it says something about what I've been preaching for years, and that everybody is unique.
Yes.
And everybody has a level of wonder and magic and spirituality that is uniquely theirs. And it doesn't matter how important they are or how successful they are or how powerful they are. They all have it. And when you gain that kind of respect for the dignity of all person kind, you free them and you free yourself. It's a wonderful space to find yourself in.
That's fantastic. I'm sitting here trying to remain quiet because I've got goosebumps here. I love your passion and your intensity. My gosh, I feel like I found a kindred soul here. What? Why did you start the love class at USC years ago? What was that? Was that in 69, 70?
Yes, it was about 69. That was really a very tragic thing for me. I mean, here I was someone who all of my life had been taught to celebrate life and to revere it. To me, it's the greatest gift that we're given. And, you know, people don't treasure it. They misuse it and mistreat it. But anyway, I've always loved life. And I gained that from my mother, who was wacky, completely wacky, and my father, who was wacky in another way, and all my wacky brothers and sisters. But anyway, I was teaching at SC, and it was my first year. I had been teaching elementary school, junior high, and high school. And then I went around the world for 3 years. And when I came back, I had received my doctorate, and I was ready to go into another phase. And so I got a job at USC and I was teaching this class, and it was one of those, you know, 1A classes that everybody has to take. It was mandated. So everybody was sitting there with this expression, and I'm sure you've seen it, try and teach me something, you know. And I just took this as a big challenge. I'd worked with kids all my life, and I realized that you grow older, but you're still a kid.
Yeah.
So what worked with the others would work with these. And so I just knocked myself out. And there was a beautiful, beautiful young lady in that class. I really can conjure her up as vividly as if I were just looking at her now. And she had everything, it seemed to me. She was beautiful. She was intelligent. We had taught her all the things that we define as being an educated person or a happy person, and that is to read, to write, to spell, to do arithmetic, to paragraph, all of those things. And she had an additional streak of creativity where she used to see things in a very unique way from everyone else in the classroom. So when I read her papers, they always took what was essential to know and transposed it into something that was outstanding to communicate. So I used to love reading her work. Was just stunning. I you're not supposed to have favorites either as parents or as teachers, but she was really a favorite. And she encouraged me by her enthusiasm in class and so on. And then one day she was absent, and she remained absent for Monday, Wednesday, Friday for about 3 weeks. Finally, I went to the section in the classroom where she sat. It was a big classroom. 101 classes and 1A classes are always 100, 200.
Right.
And I went there and asked the students around her if they knew where she was. And they didn't. They didn't know what had happened to her. And none of them were particularly concerned, which was shocking to me.
Was she a loner by herself? Or?
Well, I see. I didn't know that much about her. Right.
But you had a great appreciation for her, it sounds
like. I always made it mandated that everyone in my class come to see me. And that we'd sit down in the office, or we'd go for a walk at University Park, or we'd go to the Rose Garden. But I wanted to know you as a human being. It wasn't enough that you were a warm body in the class. And people came, but I was always waiting for the day when she would come and make an appointment, but she didn't. And finally, I went to the Dean of Women, and she was sort of shocked by my asking. She said, "I thought I told you, Leo, but this young girl went to Pacific Palisades, which many people know in Southern California is a place where there are sheer cliffs falling to the sea. And there were people there having a picnic, and they saw her leave her car with the ignition running, but they didn't pay any attention, which is so like us. And she just walked across the grass and threw herself off on the rocks below." She was 22 years young. And even though I'd always cared with a passion about life and about people, it had never been smashed at me in such a violent way. And I realized suddenly that what did it matter that we had taught this girl to read and to write and to spell and to do arithmetic and to paragraph, if no one had ever really bothered to know who she was and what her real needs were and tried to fulfill them. And so I thought, as far as I'm concerned, I can't change attitudes of everyone, but I could maybe set up something that would help. So I started a class that I call Love 1A, for want of a better title. And I said I was not going to teach it. I was going to facilitate it. But we were going to come together as a group, the students, their parents, if they wanted to bring them, their wives, their husbands, their teenagers. And we were just going to talk about love, because all at once it occurred to me that we take love so for granted. Everybody assumes that he or she is a lover, and that all we need to do is be born into the world and grow up, heaven forbid, in some of the environments we have to grow up with, wherein we never come in contact with genuine love. And yet, as adults, we're expected to be lovers. No wonder there are so many divorces and so many suicides, and because our greatest malice is loneliness.
Yes.
It's because nobody ever realizes that love is a learned phenomenon, and that if you want to learn it, like everything learned, you have to put in the effort to do so. And people laugh, you know, when you say, you've got to learn to love. And they say, well, you know, there are no classes in love. And it was true, because my love class was the first in the nation. In fact, so outrageous did people think it was that the National Enquirer came to USC? And, you know, USC is one of the most conservative schools in the country, and the president almost died when he heard that National Enquirer was going to cover one of its professors. But, you know, they came and they sat down in the class, and I refused to have them identify themselves. I said that we're not doing anything here we're ashamed of. And the reporter that covered it for the National Enquirer did one of the best jobs of anybody that covered the Love class. Wow. And finally joined the class.
Wow.
And but the point was that this kind of brought me to the realization that most of us wander through life not only not knowing what love is, but pretending to be lovers with a little bit of knowledge that we have, and unwilling really to do anything about becoming a greater lover. I mean, if you want to be a great speaker, you learn the techniques of a great speaker and you become a great speaker. If you want to become a great chef, you don't just walk in the kitchen and throw things together. You study about how to put things together so that it comes out with gourmet quality. And so it is with love.
And you practice every day.
And you practice every day with a passion. Yeah. You make mistakes. Yes. You get burned. Yeah. Your souffle falls.
Yes.
I mean, all these things go on. So you're not expected ever to be perfect. But you are expected to have the need and the desire to learn to love before the day of your death. Oftentimes, people wait until then to say, you know, I miss love. And I think when you've missed love, you've missed the essence of life.
Yes. And if people don't consciously learn to love and make that a focus and a value and they take it for granted, they tend to learn to hate or they learn to survive.
Something has to fill that.
Yeah, I was going to say, doesn't something have to fill that void?
Yes, it does. And oftentimes people that don't do that either fall into loneliness and retreat, or they become very aggressive and they become very bitter and very angry and begin to hurt others, especially seeking out lovers to hurt.
Yeah.
It seems to be a passion of non-lovers to do so. And so it's kind of a frightening dynamic, but it's true. And I think every book, every word I've ever said, every book I've ever written has been focused on don't miss love.
Don't miss life.
And don't miss life, which is one and the
same
thing.
One and the same, That's fantastic. Well, you and I talked earlier before we were on tape about the power of words and the views that we share about that. And you say you're suspicious of words, and
yes,
I hear you use words like frightened, and we had a good conversation about that also. And yet I also hear you using words like marvelous, stupendous, as you just said, outrageous.
That's why you should distrust words, is because there are idiots like myself who say marvelous, fantastic, unbelievable, stimulating, wondrous,
but
magical.
Look at the passion you have by using those words.
Nevertheless... they are very, very non-scientific.
This is true.
And they are very, very personal. And the passion that I feel for things is a very unique kind of passion, which a lot of people cannot understand.
Or relate to.
They enjoy.
Yes.
We all enjoy passionate people, it seems to me. Like we go to Italy and the Italians, oh, everything's a passion, you know. Life's a passion. Death's a passion. Tears are passion. They cry over everything. I have an aunt who is the greatest actress. When she is discovered, you know, she will win every Academy Award. But
right now she performs for the family, though.
Oh, only, and for the neighborhood. Everybody knows. But nevertheless, I've always been suspicious of words. And I think that what I base my scientific awareness on is action.
Yes.
And the trouble is, though, Tony, you see, we're stuck with words. Words are the vehicle we use to convey not only ourselves, but to convey our lives and our meanings.
Yes.
And so we use the words that we have facility with, and the ones we don't have facility with makes us less than poets. So I am suspicious of words, though I enjoy them. I love to see them bounced around magically by great orators. But then the thing that gets me to judge whether these words have true meaning is to watch what the person does.
So the final result.
It's the action. Yeah. It's what comes out of the words. But words are great fun. The big thing is to control them.
Instead of letting them control you.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Because they have a tendency to do that. You know, the linguist says that we are our words. And, you know, the words that we have and the limitation of our words are what we have to think with. We think with language. And if we have a limited language, we have a limited thought process.
Right.
And if those people who have facility with language can expand their worlds. And that's why we should never stop reading and talking and listening and learning, because the brain has no limitation. We are the ones who set the limitation, so that we mustn't accuse others. It's we must see ourselves as the culprit.
Yes. I remember reading in your one of your books about a study that was done at an Eastern university about the word communism, and they went around asking people, what is communism? And they couldn't tell them, but they knew they didn't want any of it.
That's right, and that they should be killed.
Yes,
That's even more frightening, you know. I remember one woman in that study said, I don't know what it is, but we should really destroy them because they're a danger to the world. Well, I mean, first of all, I think that maybe she's right. I don't know. But first of all, she should at least find out what she's destroying before she should ask that we go and destroy them. And it's a terrifying thing. Words can either create or they can destroy. They can enhance, you know, they can enrich, or they can deplenish. They can take away. And so we have to be very, very careful with words. And even the common ordinary words, a word that frightens me tremendously and I think limits 90% of our population is no.
Yes.
No yes, sends chills up my spine when I hear somebody say no. You know, and they say no to life and no to love and no to beauty and no to art and no to nature and no to God. And they just no their way through life. And it's terrifying because, life is yes. And love is yes, and beauty is yes, and joy is yes, and even pain is yes, not no to pain. The greatest lessons I've ever learned in my life, I've learned through pain. Now, I would prefer learning through joy. Yes, that would be the best way. But sometimes life is not like that.
Yes.
And someone you love will die or go away or something will happen in your life where you're going to have to weep. And there's nothing wrong with tears. I always say they sort of clarify the eyes and help us to see better as long as we learn. There are no bad experiences. The only bad experience is the one we don't learn from.
Mm. I couldn't agree with you more about that. You and I spoke earlier also about, I think, something else we share in common, that I have a great deal of concern with some of the people who have bought into the theory of life that says things are preordained, either because of your family or your parents. You need to go back and heal the child within you, which I think is very valuable. But when that becomes the source of who we are, we lose the ability to shape and make decisions, shape our own destiny. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what do you think really does shape destiny? And certainly our childhood plays a major role.
Well, you know, that's a very profound question. And I'm a very ignorant man when it comes to profound questions. I really don't have an answer to what it is. I can only tell you how I have tackled this, which is makes it valid for me, but maybe not for somebody else. I find that there are no real answers, Tony, to all the major questions. We can have conjectures on, you know, why death? Why not eternal life? Why suffering? Why must children be abused? Why do some people get all the intelligence and some people are born mentally retarded? How should I know? I don't really know all of those answers. I only know that if I want to live a good life, there are certain ways in which I can proceed to live a good life.
Yes.
And as long as I follow those things and I'm true to myself, then I can find joy in life.
But what are some of your answers to some of those questions for you?
Well, first of all, I think that life is good.
Yes.
And people are good. And I think that we sometimes get off the track because we are human and we're not gods. And I think some of the big problems arise when we begin to believe that we are perfect, or when we begin to believe that the world should be perfect, or when we begin to behave as if we were gods. I don't want to have power or control over anyone. My whole thesis is, because I know how important it is to me, is to free you to be what you are, to find your own answers, and then to share them with me, because in this way I become enriched. But words like tolerance, I think, are beautiful words. Words like compromise are beautiful words. And some people abhor the concept of compromise. I think it's, if you're going to love, you're going to have to learn how to compromise. You're going to have to give up a little bit of you. And I think it was funny in the 60s where people would rather die, they'd say, than give up myself, you know. And even that...
As if yourself was that limited as to that concept in the first place.
And giving, and giving, and also spending your life seeking for yourself. So many people are so bent on finding themselves, you know, that they lose themselves. They don't even know who they are. And even if they encountered themselves, they wouldn't recognize themselves. I love the story of the man who was out seeking the meaning of life. What is life? You know, that's something we also get off on. What is life? Oh, what is the meaning of life? Why am I here?
Why not just live?
Live into the answers.
And you'll find out.
Live into the answers. But he goes to this guru on this mountaintop who's been up there for 25 years contemplating what is life. And everyone's sure he has the answer. And he says, what is life? And the guru says, life is a bowl of cherries. And this seeker says, it is? And the guru says, you mean it isn't? I love that because, you know, I when you're involved in writing books about love, about living, about learning, everyone expects that you have the answers.
Yes.
And so I get these letters that say, this is happening to me and this is happening to me and what shall I do? And, you know, I write back and I say, the answer for you is in you, not in me.
Yes.
How should I know what you should do? I don't even know who you are. And you're asking me to solve your life's problems? I mean, you know.
And hopefully that's a wake-up call from you.
Well, you know, it's what it is. And what I say to them is, I have great respect for you. Because if anything I have that has made it possible for me to survive almost anything and everything, it's a tremendous respect for the dignity of every human person. To me, I think the key word is dignity. And I think that so many times we set out to destroy other people because we have no concept of their value and their worth. Or we lay upon them our concepts and our preconceptions of their value and their worth. And that's a major tragedy. I'm not here to judge you. And if I have a purpose for being, and I'm really not sure yet what that is, it would be to enhance you. And for me, a glorious day or a wonderful experience is because I have encountered something or someone that I have left a little bit richer.
What I hear you say, I hear kind of a little bit of a double message, and I'm sure I'm misinterpreting it, but while you don't have the answers for other people, you certainly want to share what you've learned and let them take from that what's valuable, don't
that's,
you?
That's absolutely essential.
Okay. Yeah, because
to have things
to be able
for myself,
yeah.
I'd go up on a mountaintop like that silly
sure.
guru and contemplate as if the world is a bowl of cherries. So when I have any kind of knowledge,
yes.
as far as I'm concerned, the only purpose of having knowledge is to share it.
Yes.
And if it's worked for you, you hand it out there, but you don't say, this is it. This is the answer.
Right.
You say, here are a lot of answers.
Right.
There are many alternatives.
So you're willing to share that with intensity. That's what you've done for years.
Well, yes, what I do and it's what I intend to do.
Yes. But you just don't want people to be dependent upon you. You've made that clear.
Or assume that what I say
is the gospel or the right
gospel.
Answer for them. Right.
That's right. Because it isn't.
Right.
Something that is fantastic for me. Look at, you know, for years people have been trying to define what is beauty. And, you know, we've got volumes, but nobody agrees. Your beautiful might be my ugly or my unbelievably repulsive, you know. So somebody walks through a museum and they look at something and say, that's gorgeous. And you think that's ridiculous. And you walk into another room and you say, that's gorgeous. And they say, that's hogwash.
Right.
You know, and that's wonderful, isn't it? Because art grows out of that. You see, the whole purpose of art is to educate.
Interesting. What do you mean by that?
Well, the artist, the creative person sees things we are not able to see. Now, we are able to see. All of us could be creative and would be creative if we believed that we could be. But somebody has defined for us in the second grade that we were not artists,
right,
or we were not dancers, or we were not great baseball players. And we believed them, and therefore right. We didn't become great dancers and great artists. So the point is that an artist sees in a way that is totally unique and helps us to see in a unique way, which refreshes us. So that we, you know, sometimes it's that kind of aha thing that you get when you walk in front of a Van Gogh painting and you see these sunflowers. And, you know, you've seen sunflowers before, but you've never seen them come alive. The vibrancy of the paints and what he saw were so uniquely his. Now I will never see a sunflower in the same way again. So the artist points out, this has always been there, but you have not seen it yet. Let me help you to see it. And then in the hopes, the real artist is like a good teacher, in the hope that then you will do something equally great or greater.
Yes.
As a result of having now awakened to what there is.
Is that what you do? Is part of what you do by living your life true to yourself is, and doing it on such a massive scale and a public scale, does it awaken people, hopefully?
Well, you know, I think it's hard for people to know me outside of what they see on a television screen or in a book, but I have to be true to myself, and then I won't deceive them.
Yes.
I don't think anybody will ever find that I have either done something that I've written about that has been untrue, or told a story as an illustration, or used a metaphor that wasn't an honest one. To the best of my knowledge, I'm true to myself, and therefore everything that I give is true to the best of my knowledge. And I think in this way, they need never be disappointed. I, you know, one of the things that shatters me, and I've experienced it oftentimes, is to have heroes. All of us like heroes. They're models. And then to meet this hero or heroine and to find out that they're dishonest and that they're phony, yeah, and that they're in whatever business they're in for their own good and for the money that they can make or the notoriety that they can achieve. And then that really hurts because you think about all the people that look at them and emulate them,
yeah,
and see them as something special. That's the reason so many people are disillusioned and think that so many people are phonies. You know, there are a lot of people that go through their entire life never trusting anyone. And that's because they've been hurt by some figure. May I give you an illustration?
Sure.
I was a couple of years ago in Boston. I was doing a talk, sharing with some nurses, and we were staying at a big hotel, which is where the conference was being held. And we had heard that in that hotel were six or seven of the top-notch baseball players of a certain team that I will not mention because that really it's neither here nor there. And the little kids in the neighborhood had also gotten onto that. Here were their heroes, these baseball players. And so they had all come there with their autograph books. And I came down in the morning on an elevator with about five of them. And one of them was a very, very famous man in baseball profession. And when the doors opened, these little kids saw this man. Oh. And one of them, with his eyes as big as saucers, walked up and said, blah, blah, may I have your autograph? And he said, shove off, kid.
Oh.
And I stopped in my place and saw the face on that kid. And I will never forget it. it's indelible. If we're going to assume the responsibility of being someone, and especially when we realize that we are human and other people are too, it gives us a responsibility to behave in the most magnificent fashion of which we are capable. And never in a million years do you say to someone that comes to you, shove off, Buster.
No kidding.
And I think about that kid, and I think about the disillusionment, and I think about his never being able to look at this model again with the love that he had when he had this dream of who this person was.
Well, the more scary thing is he doesn't want to dream again because he was hurt so bad.
It might even happen that that's true.
Yeah.
And I remember that I had a great admiration for Ethel Merman, and I feel sorry for a generation who will not be acquainted with her verve for life and her joy in her voice. And she never had a voice, a real voice. She had a loud voice and an honest voice. And when she was on the stage, she just shook the rafters. And she used to say it didn't matter to her whether she was sick, whether she was miserable, and her life was often so. When she got out there, she owed her audience a performance, and she gave it. And I used to use that for years and years and years as a model. And I remember I was writing a syndicated article for the New York Times Syndicate for about 4 years. And when she died, I had the privilege of writing an obituary in which I stressed this, that if she had anything to teach us, it was that responsibility that we have. Once we have an image, to maintain it, to strengthen it, to give it away, that's the only reason to have anything.
And to walk the talk.
That's right.
Yeah. And everything that you talk about, in order to live life the way you do, it seems the common theme you have to have is just a tremendous amount of faith in people and life, and that things happen for a reason. Is that true? And how do you look at life? And how does your faith play a role?
I like the word hope. That's kind of an open-ended. And it isn't as frightening to some people as the word faith.
Because they tie some religious context?
I think so. Faith is a beautiful, beautiful word. But hope is something, even it seems to me, beyond faith. Hope says that there are no impossibilities. Anything you can dream, you can realize. Anything that that you set out to do, you can do. Hope is essential for love, and hope is essential for life. And I think there's a difference between the kind of hope where you go with expectations, because then you're very likely to be disappointed, but hope that it will happen, and if it doesn't, having the strength to understand that this wasn't the time. Not that it can't be done.
Right.
Only that this wasn't the time, and you may not have been the person. But hope is such an open concept, to hope for things, not to expect them, but to hope for them or people.
What would you say is the source? I know there isn't any one, but I'm trying to get back to it because having done some reading about you, I know, for example, your father used to ask you every night a very important question. And I know that that certainly was a stimulant to some of this desire and passion for learning, at least maybe the initial trigger. What were some of the sources? I know your mother was an opera singer. What were some of the sources in your past that maybe have influenced some of the direction of your life and how you think today, some of those core beliefs?
You know, Tony, I think the most remarkable thing is that I have never met anybody in my life and gotten beyond the superficial level, which I try to do very quickly, usually with a big hug.
Yes.
That breaks down the barrier immediately, that I haven't found something wondrous to take away from having had that experience. Now, naturally, with the people with whom you spend the most time, i.e. my father, my mother, my brothers and sisters, my dear friends, you learn a great deal from all of those things. But I think there is, you know, there is no one that I have ever met, if I got below that superficial veneer, that didn't have something rich and wonderful to give me. So every time I'm with somebody, I think I'm going to carry away something from this situation, regardless of who they are, that I would never have had unless I had encountered them. And don't you see, that's why really I gave up everything. I sold my life insurance and my house and my car, and I went for 3 years around the world to find out who were these other people. You know, and then when we were in a war in Vietnam, I understood, because I was in Vietnam and I had learned to love the Vietnamese. And now that we're involved with all this business with the Middle East, I understand a little bit about the Middle East because I was there, I experienced it. There's great value in just opening yourself up to other people and to other cultures and to new ideas, because you will then emerge richer. Not, as you pointed out earlier, not to keep it and store it up, but to use it to help others to gain insights.
Yes.
So there were a great many people, my mother, my father, especially my younger sister, because we were very, very poor and everything had to go to the house, everything that everyone made. My elder sister had to quit school early in order to help support the family. We were a big family. But my younger sister used to always find the means, even though she made a meager salary at the time. She always found the means of giving me a dime to go to the movies. Or if she knew that I wanted a book, I'd find it under my pillow. Things like that that I never forget.
Yes.
And these people, an English teacher who once sat me outside of a bungalow in high school and said, "Did you know that you have a very lovely writing style that's very simple and conversational and easy to understand, and you could use this as a resource?" I had never known that. I mean, no one had ever told me that I could write a sentence that someone could understand. It made a difference. Somebody who said to me, "You have to go on to school." You know, my mother had very humble dreams for her family, but practical dreams. She wanted me to be a barber. She said,
"I get my hair cut by you."
She said, "Everybody has hair, and hair keeps growing, and you'll never be hungry, and you could have your own business, and so on and so forth." Well, I couldn't convince her. It was not right for me to be a barber. I had to do other things. But it took time, but she came around to it. But, you know, all these people have influenced my life, and even I meet people. Every day, I was once speaking in Florida, and a man came up to me afterward and said, "You have given me over the years so much. I want to give you something." He said, "May I take you to the Everglades? Because I have a great passion for this area." And I could have said, "Oh no, I'm much too busy. I have to leave tomorrow." But I realized that this was a very sincere and great opportunity for me. So I canceled my airfare, or my air ticket, and I went with him for 2 days in the Everglades. And it's one of those experiences I know I'll never forget. Wow. Just recently, now that I've moved up here, if you want to go really enjoy God's magnificence up here, you have to take up a winter sport.
Yes.
Because otherwise you'd be doing nothing but sitting in front of your fireplace. So here at my age, I've gone out and I'm learning to cross-country ski.
Oh, wow.
And by doing this, and by having people who have the patience to take me out and to help me to laugh at my clumsiness, I'm discovering what it's like to be in a primeval forest. I'm discovering what it's like to see a full moon on the snow. I'm discovering what it's like to know what it really means to be quiet. So, you know, it's just as if there's a lifetime of learning still ahead of me.
That's clear, and it's happening in every moment.
And every second of my life. And it's not only true for me. You know, one of the things, Tony, that I know you stress, but you must never cease stressing, is that all these wonders are not just available to a fortunate few.
Yeah.
They're available to everybody. And the more that they can latch on to that and recognize that I can't have these things unless I do them.
This session continues on the next CD.
If you want love, you don't sit in your living room and wait for love. Love doesn't come to people who wait. It's an active thing. It's a verb. You have to go out and find it. If you want excitement in your life, you've got to make it. If you want beauty in your life, you've got to create it. Don't wait for it. Then these things all come to you. It's amazing. There's just no stopping them. It's like they just catapult. They come and they come and they come. And there isn't enough of time of day or time of life for everything that you want to know and feel and understand. And that's why when my students used to say they were bored, I would throw things at them. I literally would, and I'm totally nonviolent, but I would pick up my orange and throw it across the room. And the only time that I really lose it is when somebody says, "What's there to do?"
Or when they say they can't do something. I think I've seen that response. Well,
and you know what frightens me too, and I really have nothing against, I think television is a remarkable invention, but one of the things that it does, if we're not careful, it makes us passive observers to life. 6 valuable hours to the average person every night is spent in front of that tube watching other people enjoy life.
Or fake it as if they are.
Well, they're actors, but isn't that scary?
Yes.
6 hours that you could be living a life, you are watching other people live theirs.
But the problem is people haven't been taught how to live, and we take for granted that we know how to live.
But you see, that's why they need teachers.
Yes.
And they need models.
And coaches.
To show them that life really is a banquet. And you know, you're not even partaking of it. And the wonderful thing, you know, I think the thing that awakens people more than ever, and sometimes we have to wait a long time for it, is I think the greatest teacher of all is death. Death is an enormously magnificent, dynamic teacher. It's democratic. It comes to everyone. And when you make your peace truly, not just talking it, when you make your peace with the fact that you are mortal and that you are not going to live forever, all at once things really become passionate.
More compelling, that's for sure.
You know, it's so interesting. How I cannot tell you how many people that have found out that they have terminal illnesses that all at once become great lovers of life. How many men have dropped over with momentary cardiac arrest and have awakened and said, "What am I doing? What is the direction I'm taking? This is crazy. I'm not seeing anything. I'm not loving anyone. I'm not," you know. So love is love too, but death is a great teacher. And it says to us, if we're wise, don't wait. It can come at any time. You don't have to be 90 years old to die. Little children die. So it can come at any time in your life. Know that death is there. Knowing that, step aside from it and live, because life is the gift you're given while you're waiting for death. And, you know, at the point of life, we really are already starting the processes of dying. So, you know, all of us are going to go, and it doesn't matter who you are, how famous, or how many books you've read, or how many people you've influenced, you're going to go. In fact, there is a new television show that is going on. You may have heard of it, where they're filming certain people for 30 minutes, during which time those people are asked to leave their, what is your legacy to humankind? And then they ask you once you've been selected, and I'm going to be doing mine in a few months. And it's a very interesting thing because they call it the 11th hour. And you start your talk by saying, "I have 1 hour to live, and this is what I want you to know." And then these things will be stored away, which I think is intriguing.
Yes.
And they will not be shown on public television until you die.
Wow.
They always ask the person that they've selected for the next year's presentation to recommend 3 people that they think might be exciting people to share that with. Last year, I recommended 3, and 2 died.
Wow.
So, you know, that says...
You're not going to recommend me, are you?
No. But that says something about the fact that we don't have forever. And if you're going to utilize what there is,
yes,
You're going to utilize it now. You're going to not wait to love. You're going to love now. You're not going to wait to understand. You're going to try to understand now. You're not going to wait to be an educated person. You're going to get educated now. You're not going to wait to embrace people until they're on their deathbed, which is what we wait for.
Yes.
Rather, you're going to do it now. So love is a great teacher. I mean, I always say that. That's funny. Love is a great teacher, but so is death.
But it sounds like pain still is a stronger motivator to give people a sense of urgency. It's like so much in life, people do what's urgent instead of what's important.
You know, Tony, I'm sure that that's right, except that joy would be the greatest.
Oh, I agree with you 1,000%.
You see, but
people don't experience it enough.
We don't teach joy. We don't appreciate joy. And if you are joyous, you are really considered to be frivolous.
That's
in
true.
Our culture. I mean, you walk into a restaurant and there are a group of people that are just laughing and having the time of their life, and you look at them and you think they're either drunk or they're idiots. Or, you know, or they're suspicious. You're suspicious of them because they're having a good time.
Or they're not intelligent.
Yeah. This is, you know, life, according to so many people, is a very serious business.
Yes.
What a joke. Number one, it is not a business. and number two, it's hysterical because it's not serious. And unless you have a sense of humor in this crazy world, you'll surely go mad.
And most people, I think, when I talk to people and have people in seminars, oftentimes we have exercises where we ask people to go into, an emotional state of intensity. 9 chances out of 10, even though I told them you can go in a positive or a negative state, they'll pick the negative.
Oh, of course.
Because most people associate intensity with a negative much more than do the positive. They have easier access to pain than they do for pleasure. It's not that it's more powerful. It's just that we were more wired for that as a culture. But the question I have is, so how do we change that? How do we get more people to be able to have the experience of joy? What can people do?
One thing that I can do is I can be joyous.
Yes.
And I can really be a model of joy. And I can spread within my limited realm of situations, I can bring joy and show people that joy is a valid emotion and happiness and laughter and giggling. I'm working on a new book, and this morning I was working on a little section about the value of being silly.
Oh, that's great.
You know, we don't know how to be silly anymore. We don't know how to have unstructured fun. And when I say to people, have fun, they don't know what I mean.
They get a blank stare.
And they think, oh, well, we could go play golf. But, you know, that's fun, but it's structured fun. Go play tennis and, you know, get in there and really knock that ball down their throat. Now, there's some therapy in that, too, and that could be fun for some people. But I'm talking about non-structured fun.
Yes.
I was recently at a dinner party where the conversation got very heavy. I mean, really heavy. People were talking about, you know, death and dying and morbidity and disease and all of these things. One man got up and said, let's skip around the room. And, you know, everyone was really shocked until by his saying that, he called our attention to the fact that, well, those things are so, but there is still unstructured joy to be experienced. Let's never forget it. Let's skip around the room. Let's be silly. Let's do something nutty. I always remember that. I think it was Thomas Merton said that all great lovers and saints have been transcendental clowns.
Oh, that's great.
I love that. I mean, that's exactly what it is.
What about realism? You know, so often people are focused on being realistic. And it appears to me
that... Well, Tony, if we knew what was real, then we could be realistic. I have never been able to find out what was real. I mean, what is real?
And usually most people's idea of what's real is a great deal more limited than the reality
itself.
If we knew what it was.
It's usually negative, too.
No, that's
the point. Your definition of what is reality. I don't know what reality is. I'm like that monk that says, am I a monk observing the butterfly observing the monk, or am I the butterfly observing the monk?
Or am I confused?
And I really don't know. I mean, I don't know which I am. I don't know if I'm, you know, what is this? And people have told us that, you know, life is a dream, and that we may conceivably wake up and everything we've experienced has been within the realm of fantasy. And that's all right with me. I don't care. I don't
need... You had a good time while you were here.
I do not need to know, in quotation marks. I do not need to be certain. I can live on faith.
Wow, that's real magical what you just said. You can live on faith.
I can live on faith, and I can live on hope. And I, you know, I can live on magic. And I've never, ever, ever stopped believing in miracles, and therefore they happen to me all the time. And the people that don't believe in miracles are the ones who say there are no such things as miracles.
I talked to Dr. Bernie Siegel a couple weeks back, and he said, you know, if you don't believe in miracles, then you're not being realistic.
That's true. It's the absolute truth.
I love that.
And that's not incongruous at all.
No, I agree with you.
It's that wonderful joy that language can bring, an expression like that.
Yes.
It's what the poet is able to do with just a few words, you know, the magic of putting the words in the right places so as to create. I mentioned to you earlier the beauty of a koan, and there is one that I've always loved and stays with me constantly and is a great help to me, the little monk that said, "My barn having burned down, I can now see the moon."
Oh my gosh, that's fantastic. That's great.
But you see, that's what the poet can do in the manipulation of language and symbols and metaphor to enrich our lives and to help us to see the moon. The moon is there. We don't know it because we never bother to look at it. You know, all these wonderful things, our children's faces, they're there, but we don't look at them. We don't even look at the face of the person that we love. And that's one of the great tragedies. I remember one of the things in love class I used to ask my students was, what is the color of your mother's eyes? You know that only 30% of any class that I had was able to tell me what color their mother's eyes were. But they went home and looked. So at least they didn't die without knowing, you know, when they got up to heaven and God said, what is the color? Because that's certainly one of the quiz questions.
Before you get in. That's right. I agree.
But imagine living with your mother all of those years and never, ever looking her in the eye and saying she has brown eyes or green eyes. And you know, when we really think about it, we know so little about the people that we love the most intensely. Do you know about, for instance, your mother's first date? Do you know about the first man that kissed her? Do you know about her greatest moment of despair? Most of the time, we don't have time nor interest to know about it. And these people die, and then we wonder why we have nothing to hold on to.
No sense of heritage or connection or roots. Interesting. Speaking of that, your father's question that he asked you each night that you had to answer was what?
What did you learn today, Felice? And we always had something we learned because we made a point to learn it. We used the encyclopedia continually. All of us had to have something that was it. But that was such a nice exercise, and I still use it. You know, I think what he said about going to bed is ignorant as you awakened in the morning is such a terrible, terrible thing and such an awful statement about us and about our culture.
But he established a habit in you there that was quite useful, it sounds like.
He did, and he awakened in me a great passion for learning.
Yes,
because he had it.
Yes.
You see, I think sometimes people like my father, who had the potential to be really, I think, a great thinker. He already was a great lover, but he was a great thinker. But circumstances in his life meant that he had to quit school when he was in the fifth grade. He then had an enormous family that he never let go hungry. He always had a sense of responsibility for everybody. And gave and gave and gave and gave. And his life was fulfilled. He had no regrets, and I know that because we were a year together, very close, when he knew he was dying. So we were able to talk about all these things. To think of what might have been, it hurts. But it also reminds me that those of us who are still living can still achieve all of these things. And what a pity not to be able to. Circumstances sometimes prevent us from doing it. But when there are no circumstances, there can be no excuses.
Hmm. Interesting. He not only asked you the question each night, but he wanted to know the answer.
Oh, of course.
Yeah,
We had any questions, we had to look it up, and we had to talk about it. Like, it wasn't enough to know the population of Nepal. You had to know where it was.
Yes.
So that by the time I went around the world, I knew where Nepal was. And I knew a lot about Nepal because we used to use a lot of those things as things I just learned, you know.
Yes.
And it's a wonderful way to lead a life. I mean, you're never, ever bored. And as long as you keep adding new things to your psyche, to your mind, you're a new person and you're never boring.
Yeah, that's pretty clear. You've demonstrated that pretty well, Leo. I'm impressed. Tell me about the time when you went back with your family back to the old country. You grew up, in a ghetto of Los Angeles, that kind of environment?
At that time, it was not really, it was a ghetto, but in the positive sense of a ghetto, not the negativity that we put on a ghetto.
Yeah.
At that time, immigrants that came to this country, out of a sense of identification and comfort, moved into neighborhoods together. So there were Italians living together and Jewish people living together and so on, German people. And this place that I lived in, East Los Angeles, which is now a negative type of ghetto, really, because it's a center for a lot of poverty, which is a terrible thing. But when I was there, it was a poor neighborhood, but it was a multicultural neighborhood, and it was very enriching. I mean, my best friends I lived next door to a rabbi, and I was his son's best man.
Wow.
I had Japanese friends that I cried over when they were all shipped to our U.S.-made concentration camps and parted with and wrote to all the time during the Second World War. And I had all the enrichment of that kind of a neighborhood to grow up in. So it wasn't really a ghetto. It was a beautiful place to be.
Now, at that time, it seems like, if I remember correctly, you felt a lot of hurt feelings about being stigmatized with labels and so forth.
Yeah, there were people that used to call me a WOP and a Dago and everything else, and I had to work myself through this. It wasn't easy. I also had the stigma of being very poor, and other people had roller skates. I never had a pair of roller skates my whole life. I never had a bicycle. As I said, the only book I ever owned that was really mine was one that a librarian gave me. The first record of an opera that I ever got was given to me by another dear friend. But none of that really hurt me. It helped me to appreciate and to value and to know that I had a responsibility to people that didn't have. And that's why I've spent this latter part of my life giving everything away. I have no need for anything. I set up a foundation called the Felice Foundation, which means happiness in Italian.
Wow.
And what we do is we give money to people who are involved in projects in which there is an educational component of teaching other people the joy of giving.
Wow.
And that makes me so happy because I know that once you get people to giving, they recognize that there is no greater joy.
Yes.
I mean, there's nothing we can do in our lives that gives us the satisfaction and the fulfillment of giving. And now I'm not talking just about money, which is the first thing people think about. Writing that check to the charity is fine, but it isn't the same as going there and holding an AIDS patient in your arms. And it isn't the same as going to a home for the elderly and sitting there and holding the hand of this lonely woman that nobody has come to see for days. And it isn't the same as picking up the vomit off the floor of someone who's ill and cleaning it up. Those are the things that give us that satisfaction. I've done something for the world today. I've left it better. And after a while, that becomes so overwhelming and so beautiful that you don't even think about it. You just do it because it's an innate, natural impulse to give and to share.
And most people don't realize they have that opportunity.
That's right. You know, I used to make it mandatory, among other things, that everyone in my classes give something to someone, do something for somebody else. I used to get kids that come to me and ask me, what's there to do? What's there to do? I mean, are you out of your mind? Where do you live, on the planet Venus? I mean, just look around you. There are hungry people. There are lonely people. There are children that need. There are people that can't read. There are houses that need cleaning. You know, Mother Teresa said the greatest symbol of love is to pick up a broom and sweep off somebody's doorstep. I you don't need $1 million. It's wonderful to have $1 million and to be able to give it away. I mean, that's really, I think, as far as I'm concerned, that's the main purpose of having $1 million. But you don't need it in order to give. And you feel by giving $1 million, you sometimes don't get as much satisfaction as by sweeping somebody's doorstep or cleaning up somebody's vomit.
Yes. I have and transferring that for years on Thanksgiving, I grew up fairly poor myself, and somebody came and delivered food to our home. Mm-hmm. And we didn't want to take it. My dad didn't want to take it, but we had to. And I promised from then on that I would feed people, but I'd never written a check. Mm-hmm. I went out one day just spontaneously when I was 18 and went shopping. And it was so much fun to go shopping for them and then go deliver it as the worker delivering it, not the person giving it. And we've done that every year since I was 18 years old. And seeing my four-year-old boy go out in a park where we create big baskets because we put, you know, blankets in it and, mm-hmm. You know, food and everything else. We go out there and the guy lying on the ground of an open bathroom in a park with all these clothes he's taken to different places to try and keep himself warm. And my son, I said, go in and take it into him and wish him a happy Thanksgiving. And him going in, the man lying on the floor, and all of a sudden as he puts it in and says, happy Thanksgiving, the man grabbed my son's arm and I jumped inside, mm-hmm. as you can imagine. The man just looked at him and took his hand and kissed it,
mm-hmm.
and set it back down and said, thank you. And, you know, that kind of an experience, you know, for a four-year-old, one he'll never get. I know I'll never forget it. And people need to have experiences like that, because once you've had one, you get addicted. And that addiction is a life addiction that creates the kind of passion and joy that comes through in every word you speak.
And if we must have addictions, and I think we probably must, positive addictions are wonderful.
Yes.
I mean, addictions of saying hello to people and smiling, yes. at them and sharing what you have and recognizing your responsibility to someone else. Those are nice addictions. They're, yes. healthy and they help everyone to grow. So it's a beautiful thing. And we need to teach those. You, yes. do need to, you, yes. know, we do have it innate in ourselves. But as you grow up, you become a little frightened about extending yourself. Will I be rejected? Will it be? Well, you'll never know until you try it.
Yeah.
And it's true with all the valuable experiences. Unless you try them, if you wait to find out that you're safe, you'll find out you're dead.
Safety is not high on the list for you, that's clear. Let me ask you, how do we teach people to love? We've said people have to learn to love. How?
And I don't think maybe there are some of us who can, I don't know, but I know I cannot teach people how to love. I can offer them all kinds of things, all kinds of ideas for them to think about, meditations to become involved in, things to do, but just suggestions. If you review all the books I've written, never once has any one of these books been classified as a how-to. Mm-hmm. You know, the New York Times book reviews has the bestseller list. Well, mine, fortunately, have been number one, several of mine. In fact, yes. I had four on the bestseller list at the same time at one, wow. time. And they classify books as nonfiction, fiction, and how-tos. And never once have they classified any book of mine as a how-to. And that's because I've never told people this is how you do it. I've offered 1,000 alternatives.
Metaphors and examples.
Examples of loving behavior, of examples of pain and overcoming fear and things like that. And I just say, look at this. It's really basically the way you teach. You're a very foolish person if you think you teach people by telling them things. 9 and 9 or 18. My concept of teaching has always been to set up a gourmet table and inviting people to eat, recognizing that if you have a diversity of foods, everybody will find something that he or she likes. Mm-hmm. But if you have only a few little dishes, you're going to find people that are allergic to those dishes, that dislike them with a passion, and that will never come back to your table again. So that when you bring these people to the table, you say, help yourself to whatever you want. Mm-hmm. Try it out. And if it's good and it works, why don't you try the asparagus next time or the artichokes? Because you may find that these are good. And if you don't, discard them and don't have any more artichokes. But this is the way that we introduce people. In other words, Exupéry, the great French philosopher, said that learning is a leading out, not a forcing in.
Yes.
So it's wonderful to think that all that we need to be the perfect us is already in us.
I agree.
And what the teacher does is help us to get in touch with those things and encourages us to bring them out. And when we do, reinforces them and celebrates them and says, now go in again and find something else.
Yes. Socrates said, learning is remembering. So I think that all the resources are there. Again, it's getting people to be aware of it. And as you said, metaphor and story and example seem to be the most powerful. You've certainly done an incredible job of that. A lot of the stories you pull from, it appears, there's quite a bit of Zen stories or Buddhism. Has that played a role in your evolution?
When I was in Asia, it was a very popular thing at the time, but I think I'd do it again. I was in Japan and I studied with a Zen master. And then when I was in Bangkok, in Thailand, I went out to a monastery and lived with the monks, the Buddhist monks, Mahayanan Buddhism. And I lived with them and did what they did. I went out and begged, and we chanted, and we meditated. And we learned from a great, great teacher who is still living and whom I visit often. And it was wonderful. But now all of the things that I learned, just as this Buddhist teacher said, anything that I learned there, I could have learned here.
Yes.
If I had learned to open my eyes here. So I am not suggesting that everybody pack up and run off to a Buddhist monastery. I mean, for many people, the Beatles proved this, for many people it was a waste of time.
Yes.
They went there all gung-ho about finding enlightenment and found out that they had the enlightenment they needed in London. They didn't need to go there. So there are many ways. There are many paths. There are many people. There are many teachers. And it's wonderful because that means we can choose. We can select. And we can find those teachers, those learnings that are congruous with us and take them on.
What about people who've had the same experience, the same reference in life? Maybe somebody, two people have been abused, and yet they turn out so differently. Why?
Well, you know, I think a lot of life is an attitude and a choice. One person can get slapped and turn inward forever and never extend themselves again. And another one can get slapped 50 times and walk off saying, it's okay. I mean, I don't feel it as much. The hide is harder now. but you know, I just think it's everyone kind of thinks that maybe my life is all joy and all magic and all wonder. I don't live in a separate world. I live in the same world that everybody lives in. I have to deal with the same traffic, with the same income taxes, with the same bigoted people, with the same, whatever destroys with someone else, it destroys also with me. The difference is the way in which I approach these things. And you see, I don't see that there are any really bad experiences.
It's a fairly important belief.
I think every experience has a value, and that the sad part of an experience is when you don't learn from it. And then if you don't learn from it, you go right back into it again, and you're very likely to get another slap. So you learn, you suffer, you become more, you go back into a situation again, you learn again, and so on. And it becomes a continual process where even then the most seemingly painful things to other people become very positive to you because you turn them into learning experiences. And I think that's maybe the secret, if there is a secret to happiness, is to find a way of turning all experiences into positive experiences. And you can. I mean, if you could look at the most final and devastating of experiences, like death, as a positive experience, suggesting that you live life, then anything else is insignificant. It pales against it.
What do you do? Again, I know you're not going to tell somebody what the meaning is, but it comes down to the meaning people pull from things. What would you say to somebody, for example, who lost their son at 15 years old? He was just killed in a car accident like that. And they have so much pain, and they are staying in that painful state.
I don't know if you knew it, but I did a book called The Fall of Freddie the Leaf, which is about death. And with it are two tapes about grieving. And one of the things that I stress there is that everybody has a right to feel what they feel.
Yes.
And if you didn't grieve after the death of someone you loved, you would be inhuman.
Yes.
So scream and yell and cry and beat the walls and bemoan your fate and cry over the grave and let it all hang out. And then recognize that this is all in the process of living, and that you have no control over this. That control is some greater power about which you know almost nothing. Let it be. Let it go. And then I think you can take anything. But to deny yourself because you think it's effeminate, or you think it shows your lack of control, to deny yourself your feelings is to deny a very essential part of you. And there are some people who swallow so hard over the loss of something that sticks in their throat forever, and they're never the same. Everything they see is through dark, dim curtains for the rest of their lives. And that means you've not only lost one life, you've lost two.
Or more if you have a family or
your
people
own.
You touched. Yes.
Right.
Leo, what really deters love? What
fear,
keeps it from happening?
Fear, I think, more than anything else. Cowardice. Because you see, it takes great strength to love.
To be vulnerable?
You're vulnerable, and you may be hurt. Things may not go as you hoped they would. Your expectations may not be fulfilled. All those things make you fearful. There's really nothing to fear. If you love because you are a lover, then no one can hurt you. In its other words, it's like giving away a bag of oranges to people. Not because you expect that people are going to say, oh, thank you, I'm dying for an orange. But rather, you give it away because it brings joy to you.
Yes.
So you have nothing to lose in loving. Now, it's when you have ulterior motives.
Yes.
And strings attached to your love. But don't you see, Tony, that's no longer love.
Yes.
Love with strings is just like, you know, a puppet. It doesn't work. You when you give love, you love to love. And you don't give love to be loved.
Yes.
So that there's nothing really to fear, and there's no chance of your being hurt. And that's tough to do because, you know, we're brought up in a culture that says, don't you give that jerk anything unless that jerk gives it back. You know, and the measure as to whether you're going to, how much you're going to give is determined by how much you get. You know, it always amuses me at Christmas time that people keep Christmas lists and they send a Christmas card, and because the Browns didn't send you one, off the list you go. I mean, how dare... Why, do you send Christmas cards to get them back? I mean, this is so cuckoo. And do you give a gift because you feel you must? Well, if you do, as far as I'm concerned, keep it. I don't want your gift. It's only a gift, by definition, if it's given freely. Enjoy with no strings attached, and that's true of love.
Yes.
And so when we go out saying we're in search of love, well, you're in search of what you want from somebody else's love. It's not that you're going out to give it, because, you know, you can give it and give it and give it and give it, and you never run out.
So if some people I know, one I know intimately, myself, I know that one of my patterns in the past was I always had to give more than anybody else to feel like I was being a giver, to feel like I was deserving love, whatever the case may be. And I still see that pattern sometimes in myself if I'm honest with myself. Where do you see that pattern coming from the standpoint of, is that pattern from your perception something that is fine as long as you realize it and you're experiencing the joy of giving and you're not doing it because you have to? Or,
well, yes, I think you've answered it. I really think that if you're giving, it doesn't matter how much you give. You see, you don't weigh it.
Yes.
It isn't a commodity that you, yes, can weigh. Like, you give me 2 pounds of love and then I'll give you 3 pounds.
Yes.
And then I'll be superior because I gave you 3 pounds and, right, then you have a pound you owe me. That's the wonderful thing about love. If it isn't given without strings,
yes,
it literally isn't love.
Yes.
And so when we're loving, we have really, again, back to your original question, nothing to fear,
yes,
if we're really loving. But you see, poor love, it's so debased. I mean, we blame everything on love. You know, it's like it's love's fault. It's love doesn't do this, and love is
usually
this.
A lack of love that doesn't,
well,
do those,
you know,
things.
The thing is it's not love that does it. It's you,
yes,
who does it. It's we who do it. I mean, love isn't responsible for those things. Love, in its classic sense, is so wonderful and so pure and so dedicated to growth and so concerned with the magic and wonder of life. It has nothing to do with all this negativity. We bring the negativity. You see, I'm constantly reminding people, love is very simple. It's we who are complex.
So what is love? I know you didn't define it. I know you never define it. I know you don't.
I can say this about love. You can break it down into all kinds of qualities.
Okay. Well, so what are the qualities of a great lover?
Okay, that's easy. You know, I wrote the book, Loving Each Other.
Yes.
And what I did is I sent out questionnaires to over 1,000 people that had managed to maintain a permanent relationship for like 15, 20 years. And I said to them, what are the qualities of love that enriched your love, that,
yes,
made it lasting? And the qualities were very simple. The first one, and you probably could guess this right off the top of your head, was communication.
Yes.
The ability for us to talk to each other and not to be afraid to express what we feel. You know, now people know this and know this and know this, but do they work on communication? Never. In fact, sad to say is that we've almost forgotten the fine art of conversation, wherein all these things are revealed. I don't say to go home and say to your wife this evening, now sit down, honey, I'm going to tell you about all these negative things or all these positive things. That isn't conversation. Conversation is the stuff that comes out naturally by being together and being intimate. That's when you can begin to talk about the things that really are important and that really matter. And you know, one of the things that forgiveness was way up on the list,
yes,
which is absolutely essential. And then affection. And isn't it interesting that they separated affection from sexuality? And affection was like something like 2 or 3, and sexuality was like 8. Now, if you looked at the literature, you'd think that unless you have the perfect sex life and unless you know the G-spot, you are doomed. I mean, you
22-hour orgasm.
That's right. And all these, let's practice position 48. I mean, this has nothing to do in these people's minds with affection.
Yes.
Affection is reaching out tenderly at a moment and touching someone.
Yeah.
Affection has to do with writing a little note and putting it in the refrigerator and saying, honey, I don't know what I'd do without you. Affection is when she comes home and she's dented the car and you say, it's okay, it's only a car, are you all right?
Yeah.
Though that's affection. And see, we've taken sexuality, which was a very wonderful part of affection, and we've segregated it in people's, yeah, minds. And now we talk about making out. We don't talk about making love. And you know, that's devastating when you think about it. And there again is the depreciation of love.
Yes.
We don't say, you know, I love you. We're afraid to say, I love you. And people don't hear it enough. And when they hear it, they become suspicious, frightened. They don't know how to handle it. So it's coming to a screeching halt, Tony, and it's to say to ourselves, what's really, really important? And if those are the things that are really important, am I on the path to achieving them? And if the answer is no, then stopping whatever you're doing until your answer can be yes. Other than that, there is no way that you'll ever find love, no way that you'll ever find happiness, or no way that you'll ever find fulfillment in this life.
Fantastic. One of my favorite questions to ask people is the question you alluded to earlier, which is, how do you want to be remembered when your life is over?
I want to be remembered as somebody who lived life fully and with a passion. I've been asked to write my epitaph, and I have always thought that the perfect one for my tombstone would be, here lies Leo, who died living.
Oh, no truer words could be spoken about you. Cale Gibran said, your work is love made visible, and you certainly demonstrate that every day. I want to thank you for sharing your passion and your feeling and your emotion and most of all your love. And
that's all I have to offer, Tony.
Nobody could ask for anything more.
Thank you.
God bless.
God bless you.